There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program Off the Hour. Today is January 22nd. My name is Sarah Jesmer.
And I'm Brian Jefferson. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Kanyekehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
Stay tuned.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada. CKUT.
First, some news. Vaccines are being rolled out among shelters like Resilience as of this week. The Quebec Premier François Legault said in a press conference recently that Quebec is focusing on vaccinating more people with the first dose rather than vaccinating less people with both doses. The province is reporting 1,631 new cases and 88 more deaths as of this Friday. The City of Montreal Police Department is responding to a shooting in Shaughnessy Village early Monday morning. Police say the victim is stable and are investigating. And officials announced Thursday that $56 million will be allotted to make new affordable housing units in Montreal. The province, city, and federal government say more than 200 units will be made available by 2022.
And protesters marched against curfew measures in Hochelaga this past weekend. Organizers say they're pro-science and pro-mask, but against increased policing as a solution to a health crisis. They say real solutions come from addressing housing stability and conditions in workplaces, for example. This is the second manifestation of this type since the curfew began on January 9th. This movement is backed by organizations like Solidarity Across Borders, the Quebec Association for the Promotion of Health of Drug Users, Racial Justice Collective, the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality, Montreal Anti-Fascist, No Police Solution to a Health Crisis, the Caring for Social Justice Collective, the Native Women's Shelter, Meals for Milton Park, the Immigrant Workers Centre, Proper Housing Committee, Resilience Montreal, Progressive Education Workers, some defense lawyers, REZO, the Project Intervention Auprès des Mineurs Prostitutes, the Centre for Women, and the Defund the Police Collective. More than 100 people met in Place Simone-Valois, surrounded by piles of snow, some shoppers, and SPVM officers in riot gear or on bikes. Officers gave a warning to make sure people wear a mask and physically removed someone from the crowd as speakers began the rally. It's not clear whether this person was a protester or not. He wasn't wearing a mask. The crowd began to boo as he was led away. Officers led one other person away, an older man, which brings the total to two.
Restez groupés, restez solidaires, assurez-vous de porter votre masque de la bonne façon, laissez-les pas rentrer dans nos rangs, laissez-les pas sortir des gens individuellement. On peut pas accepter ça.
Protesters then took to the streets, chanting surveillance and fines won't help social issues they see as the roots of the pandemic. The SPVM confirmed that two tickets were given out during this demo for mask violations. They did not say how much they were. Montreal policing has been a major topic in the last week. Community members have been pressing the city to make sure that homeless people aren't ticketed for being outside after curfew begins. Mayor Valerie Plante said last week she trusts the police to work with understanding.
But also, I want to reiterate that the police officers are well aware of the complexity of what it means to be in the streets. And so, though there's a curfew, they are using their judgment.
Plante changed her stance after the death of an Anishinaabe Innu man outside a downtown shelter a few days later. His name was Raphael Napa Andre. He was 51. He was known in the community and died just steps from the open door shelter. Montreal shut down the open door because of a COVID outbreak, so Andre was outside, alone. It's reported that he was hiding from police. This event changed the discussion in Montreal as Andre made news internationally. According to Jessica Glazer, a community advocate, the open door now has permission to operate 24/7 again. And the mayor then pressed Premier François Legault for an exception to the curfew for houseless Montrealers. He declined.
What I'm saying is that right now, the police people are doing a very good job. They use their judgment. And if we change the rule and say you cannot give a ticket to somebody who is saying that he's an homeless, you may have some people that will pretend to be an homeless. So I think that right now it's working well. Police, I'm confident in the work of police people, and I don't understand why Mrs. Plante is not confident in the SPVM.
In a written statement, the SPVM said Wednesday that they ask police officers to show understanding and tolerance when interacting with homeless people or vulnerable persons. Quote, when possible, these persons will be referred and accompanied to community resources where they can get the support and assistance they need, end quote. When asked how many tickets they've given out to homeless community members so far, they said while they post total numbers of violations online, quote, our statistics, however, are not broken down with the socioeconomic status of the offenders, end quote. Mayor Valerie Plante said this week, after the premier said no to that exception, that a new 100-plus bed dry shelter near Hochelaga is opening up as of 4 p.m. today, Friday. The shelter will be mixed gender and open 24 hours. Andre's family has reportedly said that they will be having a private funeral next week. Montreal community members are asking for people to wear light blue and light a candle in his honor and memory next Friday. Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. It's just after 5 p.m. I'm Sarah Jesmer. Up first on this episode, we're going to have a conversation with one of the organizers of Montreal's new Black Healing Fund. It's a crowdfunded therapy organization that started in 2020. They're opening applications next month. Here's more.
Yeah, so my name is Kat, K-A-T. Pronouns she, they. My job title for the moment is master's student in creative arts therapies. And I also do communications, project development for Black Healing Fund.
How long have you been doing that?
We started, it's all volunteer based, by the way. So, and we started during the summer. I don't know how long, from July to now, July 2020 to now.
Basic question, just to start us off. What is the Black Healing Fund and how can people get involved?
So the Black Healing Fund is a volunteer-run collective organization that collects donations from like crowdfunding, and we're looking into accessing grants as well soon to be able to provide Black folks in Montreal or the territory known as Jojage, to be able to access mental health services. And we don't like discriminate between mental health services. So it could be a mental health service with a psychologist, a psychiatrist, or it could be to pay for a meditation class, yoga class, Reiki healing, medicine woman, energy healing, any kind of healing, which is why we all wanted to call it Black Healing Fund instead of Black Mental Health Fund. So it kind of feels more broad. And so, yeah, that's what we do. And our first round of applications is opening on February 6th for Black folks in Jodagi to be able to apply and receive three tiers of amounts. So either $500, $1,000, or $1,500 to be able to pay for services over a span of time. Depending on how much they apply for.
Cool. How does it work after the application process? Say someone applies and then maybe they're approved. What happens after that?
So if someone is approved during the application process, so first of all, a bunch of people apply. We're hoping to stop the applications after 50 applicants, because depending, based on how much money we've raised since July, which is about $33,000, we can only give money to people, maybe 50 people. And so the people who are who have applied will be put through a randomization process to get the names out, the 50 names out that we're going to be giving funds to. And then we work with CUPERG Concordia. So CUPERG, when people deposit money, when people donate money to us, we deposit our money with CUPERG. And they are the ones that are going to be issuing checks to people directly to their addresses. So they would receive their checks in the mail. And we're hoping that people should be able to get their funding maybe 2 weeks after they apply. So they open on February 6th and they close on February 8th. So far, people seem really excited. When we first started Black Healing Fund, we were kind of overwhelmed with how much there's a need for it. And that's basically why it started, is because as a Black person during this pandemic, I was just sitting in my room realizing that, oh my God, my mental health is shit and I need to pay for it. And then I tried a bunch of online services, but they were so expensive. I think one of them is I don't know, these online platforms, BetterHelp. I tried that one. It was so expensive. And it just felt really frustrating to be in the middle of a pandemic. And it was also around the time that George Floyd had been murdered and Ahmaud Arbery was happening during the pandemic. And just as a Black person, and also as someone who's really in the mental health field, training to be a practitioner, it just felt really kind of dystopic to have to pay for my healing in a system that was traumatizing me. So I made a call out to people in the community that I thought might be interested in helping. Literally, I was just in my mind, I was just okay, can we just raise some funds so that as many Black people as possible right now can pay for therapy, because this is ridiculous. I'm seeing a bunch of Black people on my feed dying, and we're all angry and we're all upset, and there's a pandemic, so we can't access the social support that we usually are able to do through events, and I can't even go to the club and do something that would be harmful to me. I don't know, get drunk out my ass just so I can forget about things. So it was just that's how it started. And the response has been really overwhelmingly positive. People have been asking us about things that we don't even provide. That's how big the need is, because there's no organization that I know that specifically targets prioritizing mental health services for Black people in Montreal or in Canada, or I don't know of any. So it just, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. And sometimes it's overwhelming for us because we're realizing, oh my God, people really need this.
Mm-hmm. That sort of touches on a couple of other questions that I had, and you answered them as well. But if you want to expand on any of them, why was this created? What was the need around it? What was the moment that you yourself knew that you wanted to be part of this push?
I think the fundamental reason why this is needed is just because historically, Black people who are descendants of either people who have been slaves, who have fled slavery, We just have so much intergenerational trauma, like, in our bodies that sometimes is not addressed. And in our communities in general, like, sometimes, well, not sometimes, oftentimes, all the time, mental health is such a taboo thing. Like, we want to all, you know, put on this strong Black woman, strong Black man, strong Black non-binary person hat and just, like, pretend that everything is okay, because as a Black person, you have to be more than okay, you have to be excellent and you have to be all these things. And on a regular basis, I feel like that's kind of a pressure that is applied onto us. And so during the pandemic, that was just kind of accentuated. Not only do we have to work during this pandemic as a person in a Black body, but also see Black people dying on our time, on our timelines, and then I have to go to work or I have to go to school. And it was just like, I just had a moment, or I feel like a lot of the other people also in our the collective had a moment where we just realized, like, what is happening? Like, what is literally happening? In so many ways, this pandemic has showed us that, first of all, capitalism doesn't work for shit. Second of all, this world cares so little about marginalized people. It just became so flagrant, especially during March and the lockdown. It was like in your face, like you could really see it clearly unfolding. And so I feel like the reason why this was needed specifically now is because it was just kind of like it was too much. I was like, you're not going to oppress me and oppress me during a worldwide health crisis. Like, you can't, that's not going to happen. And so I don't know, maybe it took this kind of frustration to start something like this, but yeah, this, I feel like this has always been needed. And I feel like the pandemic was really the moment that kind of just woke me up, and it woke me up about a lot of things. It woke me up about the fact that if without grocery stores, like we can't eat. It woke us all up about a lot of things. And I feel like as members of this collective, it just hit us in a way where it was like, it was so intense that we would just, this can't happen. And so we're trying to find simple ways to mediate that.
Can you tell me a little bit more about who is on your team, who's part of the collective?
There's Nika Champagne. She's a Haitian queer musician and community organizer here in Jojage. And I also work with Nika on Fruition MTL, which is an organization that fights for space and joy and overall community connection amongst cutie BIPOC, meaning queer, trans, Black, Indigenous, people of color. And she coordinates social media communication and translates, you know, parce qu'elle est vraiment comme genre super francophone. And then there's Sultana, or Sammy, as we call her very affectionately, who's a multidisciplinary creator and just does all of our beautiful graphics and is so great at, like, putting in so much intention in helping us make sure that, like, this doesn't stop here. Like, we want to grow into a potentially more substantial, potentially nonprofit organization someday. Sam is not Black, by the way. Sam is Italian Moroccan. And Martha's helps us with our finances. And she's currently based in Ottawa. So we're, like, all over the place, just a bunch of people working together. And she also works on finding grant applications. And then there's Fatim, who's mixed Ghanaian and queer, born in Jojage, and she's a service worker, organizer, and she helps us building the roster of therapists, because we also have a list of therapists that we went out and tried to find to make sure that people can, so that once they get the funds, they have, like, they can easily access a therapist that's, like, providing funds right now, because sometimes you end up looking for therapists and, like, you call a bunch of people and I'm not taking clients right now, I'm not taking, be, you know, it can be frustrating. So we try to make maintain an updated list where, like, the therapists on our roster, people can look through, and they are currently providing services right now. And then there's Jessica, aka Bruiser. And she's a white queer mythology enthusiast. And she's finishing her degree in psychology. And yeah, she helps us out with policy and strategy development and just making sure that we don't forget anything. She's very good at like keeping us on task and stuff. So yeah, that's all of us. Yeah, so we postponed applications. We were going to release them, like we were going to release funds earlier, but then we realized just like general overwhelm and like we didn't want to do things really fast and then for them not to be of quality. So we took the time to really make sure that our roster was on point, meaning that the list of therapists was like not only visually appealing, but also all the information was there. Cause had we released the funds at the time where we were planning to release it, the roster would not have been like super complete. And it just didn't make sense for us to half-ass something. And so, yeah. And it's also important for us, as an organization with, you know, Black members and white members working together to improve the mental health of Black people in Jojagi, that we don't like cause our own burnout because it is volunteer based. So like we were like applications postponed because first of all, we need a mental health break. Second of all, you know, the money's going to be there. Third of all, we want to make sure that by the time we release the funds, you can literally just go click on the roster list and all the therapist names are there, their websites, prices, fees, super organized. You can just go find your therapist from there if you want to. And yeah, so that's why applications were postponed, because life, and we wanted to try to do our best.
That's super true about the fact that you're organizing for mental health and you don't want to make a detrimental effect on your guys's. That makes totally makes sense.
Yeah. Community organizer burnout is so real. And we just didn't want to be victims of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else that you want people to know about this fund?
So this is our first round of applications that we're opening on February 6th, but donations are like super important. Although we do have dreams of becoming a nonprofit organization where we can potentially have our own set location where we can hire therapists and hire community healers in a space, and then also have the Black Healing Fund, but like, you know, have a more holistic service. We also, right now, donations are basically everything, because like the $3,000 that we raised were based on donations. So we're trying to really hone on this concept of reparations in Black Healing Fund, because I feel like sometimes in social media discourse and just in society in general, people talk about reparations and be like talking about or thinking that, oh, if you buy a Black person's merch or if you buy a Black person's this or that, then you're no, you got a receipt. that's not reparations. Harar Hall made a really amazing graphic on our Instagram that you can go see that explains that at Black Healing Fund on Instagram. And so yeah, like we're trying to really hone in on that aspect of reparations and trying to provide, be an outlet for action when it comes to reparations, because just like we as Canadians and settlers here, we all strive to provide reparations to Indigenous folks. I feel like white settlers all around the world should really question how they can tangibly provide reparations to Black folks who are descendants of slaves, or just Black folks around the world in general, really. We have several ways for people to donate. We have GoFundMe, eTransfer, PayPal, and we also incorporated this new outlet called Patreon. And our Patreon, if people know about Patreon, it's really like a monthly donation platform where you can like donate $1, $2. And usually people do it for YouTubers or like, I don't know, artists, but like we decided to use it as a payment outlet on our platform because like this is literally the most, and like, this is as tangible as you can get in terms of reparations, like providing $2 a day from, you know, your income to, you know, on a monthly basis to help a Black person be able to access healing. That is as real as it gets, you know? And so I really encourage people, all non-Black folks, to really consider it, because our organization is really made up of people who, like, we're real people. Like, we're real people. We're not like, some of us didn't study everything necessary to be able to do this, but we are people who live in the world, and we are people who are witnessing injustice, and we are people who recognize that this is real. Like, this can be a real part of your life. And I just, yeah, I would encourage people to donate. And also businesses, we've had several businesses donate to us, such as Knox, which is an online sex toy shop that is really great here in Montreal. And I believe a few months ago in August, they donated 10% of their business profits to us, which was really like a full circle kind of moment for me, because Knox is also a company that prones, you know, sexual liberation and representation of different kinds of bodies. And so it meant a lot to see that they're trying to fight against this capitalistic rat race type mentality of just like, no, I'm a business and I make money for me and that's it. I don't care about you. As long as my product is good, you should have nothing to reproach me for or anything. But like, no, businesses, you're literally in your description, you're an entity, you are a person, you exist in this society. So yeah, you should be providing reparations too. And so yeah, our Patreon is something that I'm really excited about, because I wanna see who's gonna show up, you know? I wanna see when people talk about reparations all the time on social media, if they're really willing to put like a dollar where their mouth is.
Where can people find that on the internet, say, if they're listening to this?
For e-transfer, it's Black Healing Fund. So BlackHealingFund@gmail.com for e-transfer. Monthly via Patreon. So it's patreon.com/BlackHealingFund. PayPal, we accept as well. PayPal.me/BlackHealingFundMTL. GoFundMe, so you can find us at GoFundMe.com/black_healing_fund_MTL. I hope that makes sense.
It does. Thank you. Last question. While people are sort of putting in their applications, do you have any tips, any words for them, maybe from your own journey of sort of like self-healing as well, like any kind of tips that have helped you feel good while maybe they're waiting for their applications to be approved or not?
I would say that before applying, like while you're waiting for your application, like really, like I feel like people underestimate how hard healing can be, because, you know, it's all good to be like, oh, I'm going to therapy, but like as someone who's training in therapy, I'm coming to recognize that sometimes therapy can be very ugly. It can be very taxing energetically. Like, don't book a Zoom therapy session and then right afterwards have another meeting with anybody else. Don't ever do that. Like, don't. It's not that kind of Zoom meeting. I'm gonna tell you that right now. It's the deep spiritual shadow work that you have to do sometimes to get back on your feet mentally is going to be painful. It's going to bring out demons. It's going to bring out things that are not going to make you feel good. And so, you know, I would say that if you're someone that's dealing with something that you want to heal from that you know is very deep, call on your friends, like tell them to, like, you know what, I'm about to start this therapy program soon, and I just want to, like, outside of therapy, I would like to be able to, you know, count on somebody that I can just like vent with or talk about other things. Or like, maybe we could watch a movie after my therapy session, or maybe we could just like, maybe could you text me to just make sure that I'm okay? You know, like just gather your support system, because beyond having a really good relationship with your therapist, like having a support system is also really important in a therapeutic process. So get your people ready, you know, like have your people on call if you need them to be. Let your people know that you're about to embark on this journey, because it's also going to be a long-term journey. Like, you can take breaks from therapy, you know, but also don't expect to go into it and for it to just be like, oh my God, I feel better now. And it was only one session. That is never, ever, ever, ever going to happen. You might feel momentarily good because like your therapist said something that really like landed, but you still, you know, there's still work to do. And yeah, like it's a process, and be patient with yourself and be kind with yourself. Yeah.
Do you have anything else that you want to talk about that I haven't asked you already about?
Another thing that I would like applicants to consider, or that we would like applicants to consider, is because like we would like to exist in a world where no Black person that lives in this current world context ever has to pay for therapy or healing or rest. but we're not, unfortunately, in a world like that. And like, that's something that we're striving for. We fundamentally believe that that should be the case, that no Black person should have to pay for therapy in this world context. But we're striving towards that. And so funds are limited. And so we ask that until we reach, we are in a situation where we can be like, you know what, regardless of intersectionality, everybody apply. Until we're in that context, based on like how much funds we have access to, we ask that participants, you know, really consider, even as a Black person applying, consider your social positionality, which is like the different privileges that you have access to in this social system that allow you to access, that allow you greater accessibility to other folk, like whether that be income, colorism, your sexuality, gender identity, physical ability, mental ability. And like, you know, if that means applying for, that's why we have tiers of funds. Like if that means applying for a lower tier of funds, like 500 instead of 1,500, then we encourage people to do that. And if that means applying not applying for the funds at all until there is more funds, then we encourage people to do that. And I really wish I didn't have to say that, because like I said, we really fundamentally believe that no Black person should have to pay for therapy ever in this current world context. But yeah, we're trying to get the funds out to the people that have less access socially.
That was Kat, a master's student and an organizer with the Black Healing Fund. You can connect with them at blackhealingfund.com. And if you're in Montreal and want to hear more about group mental health resources in the city, check out the local branch of Girls Action Foundation on Facebook. They're offering 8 free group sessions for specific communities in Montreal North, Park Extension, and Côte-des-Neiges. Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to Juice Jam's Wide, J-U-S-J-A-M. They're part of a label called Broken District, who are releasing an LP today. For the second segment of Off the Hour, educators and students with the Intercollegiate Decolonization Network met this week in a webinar to talk about ways to transform traditional CEGEP education. They say they hope to tackle systemic racism in the Quebec colleges. Writer Kote Natewe, an Anishinaabe student at Dawson College, says the province is behind on acting and people are feeling the effects.
Why is Quebec more late than other provinces? Well, I guess it's just because Quebec doesn't recognize that systemic racism doesn't exist. You know, Legault said it himself, it doesn't exist. And clearly it does in so many examples, but with the most recent one, you know, with George Sechequan, you can't even go to get the help you need, the help you need to be healthy. And even there's another one from Ganasadage, this old man, he was sent home in nothing but, I forget what they're called, what you wear when you're in the hospital, the gown, nothing else. And that's just the health system. And we go look at the the legal system. You know, they call it the justice system, but is it really justice?
Miriam Imak is an Inuit student at John Abbott College. For this next segment, she'll explain how the network's mission extends past just changing course content.
My name is Miriam Imak, and I come from a village in Nunavik called Kangiksolochak. I moved here when I was 2 years old to Chojake, colonially known as Montreal. And yeah, been here ever since.
You are a student, right? And you're part of the Intercollegiate Decolonization Network. Can you tell me a little bit about that network?
It's a grassroots network of mainly Indigenous, either faculty or students and non-Indigenous faculty, professors, who are coming together to find ways to act upon dismantling colonization within the Sejeb school systems, addressing particular, I guess, blocks or obstacles to overcome within their specific Sejeb.
How long have you been part of that network?
I've been a part of the network for, I'd say, about a year now. It was within my third semester that I started to get more involved and invited into these groups and this circle of people who are looking to make change. It's given me a space to be able to speak my realities within the school system. It's also put me in a space where professors and deans are on the same level, I guess you can say, in terms of validity in a sense, because if we look at school systems in general, there is a hierarchy within who can make decisions and how certain funding and big decision making is up to this creates a safe space for people to collaborate and to learn from each other, because as a teacher, you're going to have to be a perpetual student to be a good teacher, and vice versa. To be a good student, you also should be able to teach. And I feel like that's the kind of dynamic that is fostered within IDN, which is really powerful and uplifting.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what you shared at the webinar this week?
Yeah. So this week we spoke about mainly our experiences within the school system. So my mom and I moved to Chojake when I was 2 years old for a multitude of reasons. And it's mainly to gain access to resources that have been granted to the, or given, I guess, to the settler population in Canada in Chojake, but they are not given to the people in the remote communities in the north, such as drinkable water and proper healthcare resources, or even mental health care is non-existent in the north. Adequate housing is definitely something that we wanted to be able to access, and that's not something that is easily to come by in the north. There is usually overcrowding and a whole lot of lateral violence due to intergenerational trauma caused by the Canadian government and assimilation. So with all that, we came to Montreal and we went to school. I mean, I went to school in Montreal, Jojage, and my experience was that I'd always be like the token Indigenous person, especially within history class, where there was a lack of truth and I didn't see myself properly represented in these books. And so I didn't really have a full scope of who I really was and where my ancestors came from. And one of the questions I was asked was if I lived in an igloo, which is a really good reflection of how Canada wants to erase us completely and how they've enforced this in so many different aspects within law, but also contemporarily within how they're educating their youth, who then don't know the truth about the history, so they don't fully comprehend what we're facing on an everyday basis. They go into like professions like healthcare and policing the law when they can't fully help us because they haven't been given the adequate training and education as a child as to where they are, where they're standing, where are you located right now? What is the history of this location? And how does your privilege affect those who have been oppressed and are still being oppressed? So within high school, the same thing happened. Like there was no proper education on what really happened. I was misrepresented. We were seen as like frozen in time and that we don't really exist contemporarily. And like what that means to be a contemporary native when a lot of our culture has been taken from us and we are seen as like non-existent. So it's kind of like this one foot in, one foot out kind of scenario and trying to like map that whole scenario out. And then in Sejeb, that was the first time where teachers themselves brought content of truth. I met one of my favorite professors and she introduced teachings of the elders and the relocation, the forced relocation of Inuit people, the dog slaughters, all this was new information to me. And I was only receiving this in Sejeb. And that really flipped it all for me. And it wasn't because of the Canadian school system that implemented this information into the textbooks or like anything like that. It was the teachers themselves that found it important for their students to know. So that's where I learned a lot of what I know now. And that's where I also learned about IDN and working to decolonize the school system.
In your experience, like being communication and being like in community with people with IDN, did you find that you were hearing the same stories at different CEGIPs and different institutions around the school system? Did you find that your experience at John Abbott was echoed in different places as well?
Yeah. Within IDN, it's like a multitude of different CEGIPs who are working towards the same end goal. And I feel like this is great work to, like, if we look at this like a tree, we're like pruning the branches. And it's important to fine-tune things, but the school system of Canada is rooted in genocide and assimilation. So I feel like they're, like, this needs to be totally uprooted to really bring balance and equilibrium. But I feel like IDN is really good first steps to be able to even reverse this pyramid, where instead of having it like the few make decisions for the many, it would be more of like the many making decisions for themselves. You know how Indigenous people have been doing this traditionally, and bringing this more into the forefront. It needs to be totally like uprooted to benefit everyone. Like, this isn't just going to benefit the Indigenous people. It's going to benefit every single person, because there's so many different ways of learning, right? And I just feel like it's so limiting how we're taught in the school system to absorb this information and like regurgitate it and take other, like, it's one way of learning, right? And it can bring a lot of understanding, but that's not the only way. We can be learning in so many different holistic ways and integrating different knowledges and teachings to be able to have a more self-determining angle of comprehending our realities and sharing knowledge and sharing information within like a cycle, instead of like I teach you as like a professor looking down to the students, more as like we teach each other, and breaking down this illusion of like hierarchy, because that doesn't work. Like, it hasn't worked for the majority of the students, for their mental, emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're talking about not only like a reformation of content, but also a reformation of like the style of teaching and the actual framework that means what is actually learning.
Right. Yeah, because it seems as though the school system now is preparing us for the job market, right? And these job markets are usually working for like large corporations and to build the economy. Whereas like learning and education happens every day. And like, it's not just what we read in a book, it's what we experience in our lives and how we learn from even our mistakes and to transmute them into like what we're going to do in the future. So it's also experiential what we learn. And I feel like that needs to be integrated, and to work in community and to know what that truly means. What does it mean to be in a community anymore? Like, I feel like we're, the tactic that is to divide and conquer is so instilled in us that it's more about getting ahead than to work, when it would be so much more potent and powerful to like build bridges and alliances and to work together and build something even more powerful and beautiful that we couldn't do alone. So like building gardens and learning how to live sustainably so that we don't have to depend on higher forces who want us to depend on them and to play God in a sense, that has to go.
Specifically about your CJEP experience. One, I have a question about like, what are you interested in studying? Like, what type of topic are you looking into? And in addition, how has this last year of online school been for you?
What I love to do is, well, like right now I'm loving what I'm doing in my classes because it's focused on my culture, and we're learning more about the utilitarian aspect of like our clothing and how much like we integrated science into what we did in our everyday lives without labeling it as science, you know? The formation of our igloos and the just bringing it back, going back to how friggin' amazing cultures are, and specifically our culture is, and the revitalization of all that was taken and all that we're taking back. So I'm just loving that and learning my language, Inuktitut, my mother tongue. I used to speak Inuktitut when I was a little girl, and I lost a lot of it on the way. So just like going back to learning more about it and working to speak fluently in Inuktitut. So that's what I've been loving, especially incorporating art into it. And in regards to COVID, it's been pretty intense, especially with the homeless population. Like I've been volunteering at a shelter, and it's been like nerve-wracking because I'm thinking of my health and well-being, but these people don't even have like a space to go to, and we're confined in our homes when all I want to do is like go out and like be present and be like, I feel like I need to be doing something. Like I feel like it's the reverse of what's going on, where these huge corporations are continuing their work, whereas like these little businesses are seen as like non-essential, which like is so reversed to me. And like these people in power are like, they have power, you know, like they choose what happens to people, everyday people, especially people who are vulnerable. So it's so important for these people to be cultured and who know the reality of the everyday person and stuff like that. But like, yeah, within COVID, I just feel like it's made me look at myself more and be more introspective. And it's forced me into that space.
If a university student was listening to this, what would you want them to know about schooling, about how your conversation about changing and decolonizing CJEPs also applies to them?
It's a beautiful accomplishment, but it should also be understood that that is not the only way of receiving knowledge and to have a powerful opinion, because experiential knowledge is just as potent, you know. It's important to understand where even the CJEP university system has roots, and that every way of learning is like a beautiful way, and it's not necessarily that everyone learns in that way and that it's okay, because it doesn't make one person more innately valuable than another because they have a degree, you know, or that they are smart or intelligent. There are many ways of learning and knowing, to just keep that in mind. That's what I would say.
That was Miriam Imak with the Intercollegiate Decolonization Network. To learn more about the network and to read action steps that students can take in their own schools, they're at idn.netboard.me.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask, and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT. I'm Brian. In news you can use, there's going to be some changes to laws and policies this year. Quebecers can expect a small raise in the minimum wage in May, an increase of 40 cents. Three new immigration streaming policies will start in 2021, like for orderlies, food processing industry workers, and AI developers. Hydro-Quebec will also increase their fees for their customers. The Crown Corporation announced plans to increase electricity rates by 1.3% starting April 1st. If you're in Verdun or the Southwest neighborhoods and looking for a place to ride out the curfew, street workers have set up a communal space. You can reach organizers by calling 514-704-5973. That's 514-704-5973. And a pilot project launched this month to connect local health or social services and Montreal Indigenous networks. The Montreal Indigenous Health Line runs from 9 p.m. to 9 a.m. They are at 514-367-3010. That's 514-367-3010.
CKUT. On the air, live for CKUT. CKUT. CKUT.
Hi, this is Sarah again. Speaking of phones, we've set up a voicemail box at CKUT. We want a place for you to let us know how you're doing during this time when we're all isolated and separated. Call and leave us a 3-minute voice message and tell us how you're feeling, what you're doing, or ask a question that you want us to answer. We might play them over the air. The number is 514-448-4041, extension 7000. 514-448-4041, extension 7000. Add your voice to this show. Thanks.
And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, made by Montreal's Community News Collective, which includes myself, Brian Jefferson, Grace Cobble, and produced by Sarah Jesmer.
And you're listening to Juice Jams Wide, JUSJAM.
For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News by sending us an email at newsintern@ckut.ca. You can also connect with us on Facebook by searching Off the Hour or CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next. See you next week.
These folks at CKUT love their 100% certified organic and fair trade gourmet coffee from Saint-Tropez. Prepared in the heart of Montreal with beans from all over the world, you can find and get your own cup of freshly brewed Saint-Tropez coffee from AUS Snacks on McGill Campus or from Café Saint-Tropez on the corner of Saint-Urbain and Duluth.
I need a fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh cappuccino with a mocha twist. Fresh.
Sont notre meilleure protection pour lutter contre le virus. C'est pourquoi, en tout temps, il faut continuer de respecter les mesures sanitaires de base, comme maintenir la distanciation physique de 2 mètres, porter le masque et se laver les mains régulièrement. Les déplacements et les voyages sont à éviter. En cas de symptômes, il est important de se faire tester rapidement et de respecter les consignes d'isolement. Découvrez toutes les mesures en place à québec.ca/coronavirus. On continue de bien se protéger. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Quand vos parents ont besoin d'aide, vous êtes là. Quand vos enfants ont des craintes, vous êtes là. Quand vos amis vivent un moment difficile, vous êtes là. Soyez là pour vous, comme vous l'êtes pour vos proches. C'est possible que la situation actuelle vous fasse ressentir des émotions difficiles ou même de la détresse. Si vous éprouvez de la difficulté à réaliser les actions du quotidien, des solutions existent. Rendez-vous sur québec.ca/allez-mieux ou appelez Info Social 811. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Bonsoir tout le monde, bienvenue à l'émission Café, votre émission culturelle du vendredi soir sur les ondes de CKUT. Il est 18h et c'est Alex qui vous parle et au nom de toute l'équipe, je vous souhaite donc la bienvenue. Même si tous les soirs se ressemblent de plus en plus en cette ère de confinement, nous allons quand même essayer d'égayer la prochaine heure avec un programme 100% culturel, comme à notre habitude. Donc, au menu ce soir, Esther nous parlera